Hi, my name is Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. I would like to thank the committee and everybody who has anything to do with putting on this lovely conference for the opportunity to be here. It's an honor. And what a beautiful place. It's just amazing. I'm feeling somewhat more settled down. This weekend has had an interesting start for me. I got a call from Keith Wednesday afternoon. I hadn't called in my plane reservations, and he called me and he said, "I'm just checking as to when you're arriving." And I said, "Well, everything's all set. My plane comes in at 5:30 Friday afternoon." And he said, "Well, that's interesting because you're scheduled to talk at 4 o'clock Friday afternoon." We changed that around, and I arrived at noon, and my bags will arrive at 5:30. So, if any of you, and if they don't, you'll take a good look at my sport coat because you'll be seeing a lot of it this weekend. One of the nice things about having now been in the program a couple of years is now when I get a chance to come to places like this, I'm now seeing a few people that I've had the wonderful opportunity to have spent time with before, and that always makes me feel more at home. Warmed, and I do feel warm. I tell a little story that kind of describes how I feel when I stand up at a podium and at an AA meeting and speak, and it's about a man who was a nuclear physicist, and he traveled the country giving a talk on nuclear fission, and he had a chauffeur, and he'd go up and down giving this talk at these different towns, and one day he was driving into this town, and he said to his chauffeur, he says, "You know, I don't feel very well." He said, "I'm tired. We've been on the road for 3 or 4 weeks," and he says, "I don't feel like getting up and giving that talk this afternoon." And the chauffeur said, "Well, doctor, why don't we trade places?" He said, "I've been on the road with you now," he said, "for 6 months, and I've heard you give that talk 50 or 60 times. And he said, "I could give that talk." Doctor thought about it for a while, and he said, "Well, you know, really not that big of an audience. There's probably only going to be 25 or 30 people there, and that might be interesting." So they trade places, and they drive into the town, and the chauffeur got up, and he gave this talk, which was, you know, pretty complex, and he gave it verbatim. He never missed a lick. He got up, and it was just letter perfect, and there was quite a response in the group of scientists that were there, except afterwards they had a question and answer period, and one of the scientists got up and asked a question, a very complicated question, and the chauffeur looked at him and he said, "You know," he said, "basically that's a very simple question." He said, "As a matter of fact, it's so simple, I'm going to have my chauffeur answer it." And if anybody has any questions about the content of my talk, I may have to defer to some of my elders about the interpretation of that. I will share what it was like for me, how I came to our wonderful organization, and mostly what's going on in my life today, because hopefully a lot's going on today in my activity and in involvement with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 14 years old, and I didn't know it then, and completely didn't know it then, but looking back on it with the information you've given me, I've come to find out just how significant an event that was for me. And to relate just how significant it was, I'm going to have to tell you a little bit about the person I poured the first drink into. And that kid was 4'11", he weighed 95 pounds, and he was the second smallest kid in his class. And as far back as I can remember, I never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different. I wanted to be taller or better looking or more athletic. I kept trying out for football, except I had a back problem. I had a yellow streak down the back of it. I just wanted to belong. I wanted to be comfortable. There seemed to be, no matter where you are, there's a group of people who are kind of the in group of people. They just seem to be more comfortable with life. By accident, they seemed to just have a facility to live well. It's like they knew something that I didn't know, and I just wanted to find it out, because everything seemed to be a lot tougher for me than it seemed to be for the people who were around me. It just didn't seem to be that tough. At 4'11", there were only two girls in the whole high school class that we hung out with that I could date that were shorter than I was, you know. Thank God they were wonderful girls, and that was kind of fun. Then I grew a little bit. But my face would always break out at the wrong time. I didn't think I shaved until about 6 months ago. And all those things that really kind of, you know, stood you in good stead, you know, if you were going to be stand up and counter. If someone could have crawled inside of me or if I could have, and really found out what the most important thing was in my life, it was belonging. Okay? I wanted to get to be part of that group of people who were the in-group. And I thought maybe that just by association, then I'd be okay, because I didn't like me very well. So I started to develop the capacity to be what I thought they wanted me to be. I don't think that's abnormal. I think that's normal. But I think that that feeling was more magnified in me. I think alcoholics have normal feelings, but they seem to be magnified. And I was good enough at being what they wanted me to be that I got to belong to that group. Except even after I got there, I didn't feel like I belonged. Because I felt like I was there because I was paying my dues. And if I ever stopped being what they wanted me to be, they wouldn't want me anymore. And one night we were out at a party, and a friend of mine had a fifth, and we went out and we split that fifth, and I made a discovery. And the discovery was is that when I put alcohol inside of Bob Bazan's, I got a feeling of comfort and well-being, the likes of which I had never experienced up until the time I took a drink of booze. I heard a man describe it once. He said it was as if when God put them together, he left a few nuts and bolts loose. And when he took his first drink of alcohol, it was like someone snuck up behind him with a great big screwdriver and just kind of tightened it all up. Okay? I didn't feel like I was a member of the group after that. I felt like I owned it. I was able to move within that group of people with a facility and ease that I never experienced before. All of a sudden, I wasn't aware of the things about me that made me inadequate. I felt very good. From that time on, I jokingly say I became a social drinker. Every time anybody else said, "I'll have a drink," I said, "So shall I." I just never passed up an opportunity to do it after that. When you do a lot of drinking and you're underage, you get into a lot of trouble. And I did both those things. And by the time I finished high school, my drinking problem, in quotes, was the largest subject of negative conversation in our home. And I come from a really neat home. I have a lovely mother and father. I'm one of seven children, great group of brothers and sisters, really a very lucky guy. And I thought my drinking problem was their attitude about my drinking. Okay, I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought that, you know, when you're underage and you get caught either by my father or the police, it never made any difference if you had one drink or ten. That was never, the question was never how much were you drinking. The question always was, were you drinking? So I never wanted to run the risk of getting caught with one drink. You know, that never made sense to me. So I always got the job done. But it occurred to me that if I could get someplace where I just wasn't forbade to drink, that my drinking would become normal. And so I had a chance to go away to school. And I took that opportunity and I went away, and I guess had my drinking normalized, I wouldn't be with us here tonight. Tonight, you know, all drunks think when we get in the room, it's nighttime. I guess it's afternoon, I suppose, if we're technical. Someone else said that, too. It's good to be here tonight. I'm going to pretend it's night. I don't think 4 o'clock is, you know. We'll do a lot better if we pretend it's 7. I think, whatever, you know, you'll be better at listening, and I'll do a little bit better at presenting, maybe, and we'll pretend it's 7. But I had a chance to go away to school, and I took it. And a big part of that decision was getting out from underneath of my father's and parents' thumb. And to make a long story short, I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. One day I just walked out. Now, that was a really important piece of my life and an important piece of my status. You know, when you're a kid who really is kind of aware of how other people look at you, going away to a school, you know, especially if you're from a Catholic group of people, going to Notre Dame, that's kind of, you know, nifty. And that was a big part, a big thing for me. And losing that just wouldn't have seemed possible to me. And one day I just walked out, never even made a decision. Now, in high school, I started to get attention for the way I acted. One of the things I got attention for was drinking. I was good at it, and I did a lot of it, and it was like almost people would come to me after the weekend and want to know what I did. From 16 years on, I was the guy who made false identification cards, and it was a big piece of my being someone or being something. And even though I changed in my pattern of life and how people were judged started to change a little bit, I never gave up trying to show people what I thought they wanted to see about me. Now, here I had an opportunity to do something pretty neat with my life, and I never gave up the feeling of responsibility that I had to show you what I had been showing you for a long time, that cool part of me or whatever it is. I can remember You know, my idea was that I drank very much like my friends drank, and I guess looking back on that, there was some truth in it, but the truth was that I drank similarly to my friends, except I just picked different friends and did it more often. In high school, I was doing it one night a week and two nights a week, and in college, I was doing it six nights a week, and my friends were doing it on the weekends. And I never understood why they went back and they didn't keep at it. They weren't no dedication in that group. They don't make them like they used to. You know, I'd be out there, you know, like it was my job, and I recalled an event that happened to me that I think describes my drinking career as much as anything. Freshman year, I was going through Chicago on the train. We stopped off in Chicago, and I was in the lobby of the Drake Hotel, and I was walking down the mezzanine, and I looked in the window, and there was a liquor store, and it was the biggest bottle of booze I'd ever seen in my life. It was a gallon. We didn't have gallon bottles in Minnesota. We had little half pints and quarts. And I saw this gallon, and I just absolutely had to have it. And I cashed in half my train ticket, and I bought this thing. And I know that when I went to school, if you got caught drinking, you were done. I mean, there was just no conversation, no nothing about it. You were in at 10:30, there was lights off, they had a guard check in. It was not quite the way things are today in school. And so I bought this bottle, threw it in my trunk, went down to school. And one Saturday night or weeknight or whatever the heck it was, I was at my desk and I must have gone out and I'm drinking. I got a little flask and I'm reading and drinking. And I must have gone out for a potty stop and come back in and didn't lock the door. And all of a sudden, the guard's in my room. Now, my college career is over. I'm sitting there with a bottle, a little flask, and I'm sitting there having a drink, and it's done. And I got between the guard and the door, and I said, please, don't leave. I mean, you can't walk out of here and ruin my life for this. You know, for me sitting down here having a couple of drinks, I know I'm wrong. I know I shouldn't have done it. Everything I had was right up there in the line, and for the next half hour, I pled with that man, please not. I went over to the sink, and I poured out that flask and begged him not to go turn me in, and he didn't. And 2 hours after he left, I went back to my locker and took down the gallon and refilled the flask and went back to drinking. And I didn't do that to be smart. I didn't do that because I had fooled him. I didn't do that because I thought that, you know, I'd really pulled the wool over his eye. It never occurred to me until a couple of years ago the impropriety of what I had done. That one moment, everything I had was right up there in the line. The crisis goes, I get by it, and I go right back to doing what I was doing. See, I lost by that time, I had lost the ability to predict my behavior once I took a drink of alcohol. I was already beyond that point. So one day, I was no longer able to maintain myself as a student and whatnot. I started out as an A student, ended up as a C student, and one day I just walked out. And I had to have a medical release because I was due to be commissioned in June, and they wrote back to my doctor, and I got a medical release, and the diagnosis came back chronic alcoholism, age 21. And I showed up back at home to a set of very disappointed parents. I finished school in St. Paul. And about that time, the family and I reached the mutual conclusion that I didn't belong at home. I think I was out on a four-day alcoholic research project and came home and found my suitcase on the back steps, is about how that went. And armed with my degree and my newfound freedom, I struck out to make my mark in the world, and I took a position as a carry-out boy in a liquor store, which subsequently proved to be a mistake. At the time, it seemed like a heck of an idea. And I lost that job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck, and I got a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis living on Skid Row. I was drinking a quart and a half of booze a day. I weighed 210 pounds. I had lost contact with everybody that I grew up with. My days consisted essentially of getting up in the morning and taking a couple of Dexedrine and drinking a six-pack of beer. That's the breakfast of champions, in case anybody isn't aware what the breakfast of champions is. And going to work and working from about 11 o'clock to about 1:30. And then from 1:30 to 4, I'd go to a bar and drink as much beer as I could drink. And then at about 5 o'clock, I'd buy a quart of Southern Comfort. And I'd go back to my thing, keep that in my locker, and I'd carry a little half pint around me and fill it up all night. And then I'd go find someone to live with for the night. We had a guy that I worked with, and his wife was a prostitute, and he was a heroin addict. And for a while, I lived in the room she worked out of. And she used to have a customer, and I used to have to go walk the streets till she was done, you know, and then I'd go back. I didn't sleep very well, but the price was right. And One of the things that almost killed me as a practicing alcoholic, but it has been absolutely no end of joy to me as a recovering one, is I've never been able to watch anybody live. You throw me in the group of people someplace, and I'm going to be part of that group of people. I just happen to be part of a damn sick group of people. And I was a leader. I lost that job because I got beat up so badly I couldn't go back to work. And I did what I always did when I really ended up in trouble. I went back to my family and I said, "Can I come home?" And they said, "Yeah, you can come home. If you follow certain rules, please." And I, like a good little drunk, I promised to follow the rules, and they let me back in the house. And I don't know what alcoholism and all its circumstances meant to you, but one of the things it meant to me is about every 6 months I had to start my life over. I kind of existed between crises. You know, I just kind of coasted along until some significantly bad event happened to me that I had to stop. And then I went around and I picked up checks and told lies and got everything straightened out until everything got precariously back into place. And then I just kind of existed again. That, the frequency of that was about every 6 months. And I was one of the world's greatest starter overs. I was not one of the world's best finishers, but I was really a hell of a starter over. And about this time I made probably the most serious effort of putting my life back together that I had ever done. I knew I was in serious trouble, and it occurred to me that if I could put certain things into my life, it would make it okay. So it occurred to me that if I could find a woman that I loved and that she loved me, that would make a difference. It occurred to me that if I could get away from the relationship I had with my family, you know, that would make a difference, which is interesting because I was just moving back into the house. And it occurred to me that if I could get a job that was really kind of a career sort of thing, that then I could get about the business of living life, and you know, and that would make a difference. Now, I started to put those things into my life that would make it okay. There was a girl that I had gone with for a couple of years and broken up with for some time, and we got back together, and not too long after that we became engaged and married, and today I'm very happy to report she's my very lovely wife, who I wish could have been with me here this weekend, but we have two little boys, 7 and 9, and it isn't always easy for us to be together on weekends like this. I was engaged and married. I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern, and I bought my first automobile. I thought, hey, it's really going to happen. I'm finally going to become what I always wanted to be when I grew up. Only it didn't happen because I continued to drink and continued to have difficulties. Long story short, I left that job after 6 months with that keen sense of alcoholic timing that we had, and I had made a decision that what I really needed was a job that had more freedom, and I took a job selling. And I had that job about 4 weeks, and I went out on a 4-day drunk. And the first day I called in, and the next three I didn't. And I woke up in a friend's apartment one afternoon, and I didn't know if I had a job. I didn't know if I had a fiancé. I didn't know if my family would allow me to continue to live at home until I was married, and that was an economic necessity. The way I had a problem that I've heard described as I spent money I didn't have to buy things I didn't need to impress people I didn't like. That was a disease I had in my alcoholism and through part of my sobriety. And I just woke up and I was scared, just absolutely scared stiff. And all of a sudden the suggestions that I had had from my psychiatrist and family and a few people about Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so impossible. And I picked up the telephone and I asked the operator for the number of AA, and she gave it to me, and I called and I got the automobile club. Just how everything went in those days. And that lady, believe it or not, must have had that call before, because she gave me the number of AA. And I called it, and two fellas came out and met me at a diner, not too far from where I was. And thank God these two fellas knew how to make a 12-step call. As soon as I hung up the phone, I was sorry I called. You know how that is. The blood starts to move around, and you think you're going to live, and, you know, it's... And I was reasonably sure that that was a mistake. I mean, I knew that I felt real guilty at the time I made the call, but, I mean, my gosh, not that bad that I had to call that group of people. And the only reason, in all seriousness and my delusion, that I went out and saw those men is I wanted to see what an alcoholic looked like. I knew all minorities look alike, right? And I thought I'd go see what a couple of them look like. And I'd come back with a better idea as to why I was not one. And so I went over and met him. You know, if you wanted to talk to me about my drinking problem, you had two choices. You also had to be willing to discuss the rottenest thing I knew about you. Or you had to be willing to wade through as much anger as I could put out. And the idea was that you can come and get me, baby, but it ain't going to be for free. And you ought to know that before you come. And as a result, not too many people had heart-to-heart chats with me about my alcoholism. But these two fellas had a different approach. I never had a chance to tell them that they had the wrong information, that they didn't understand, because they didn't talk to me about me. They talked to me about themselves. They told me what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today, and they gave me an opportunity to identify my alcoholism through their experience, and I'm very grateful for that, because for a long time, I didn't carry that message. I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'll say it. I thought it was in poor taste to talk to people on a 12-step call about drinking. I used to talk about the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship and the program and the steps and the meetings, but I never very often told my story. And it was embarrassingly long, but it was a number of years before I really learned what my message was, and my message was and is, as I see it today, my personal experience as a problem drinker. And that these two men knew that, and they asked me if I'd go to a meeting, and I said I would, and I did, and I was allowed to make a couple of discoveries at my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous that I'll share with you. And before I share with you those discoveries, I want to share with you the attitude with which I walked in the front door. And it was really an attitude of confusion. I generally tell a joke here that my wife asked me not to tell, and I won't tell, which describes my confusion. I'll just tell you that I was confused. I keep searching for a definition of alcoholism, and one of the best definitions I've heard is a contrast between an alcoholic and a normie. And they say if you put an alcoholic and a normie in a room, and there's two doors out of the room, and you go out that door, and there's happiness forevermore. And you go out this door, and there's a guy out there with a baseball bat, and he hits you between the eyes. Now, the normie will get up and go on over to that door, and he'll open it up, and he'll get hit between the eyes and knocked down, and he'll come back in. And then he'll get up, and he'll go out that door, and he'll be okay. Now, the alcoholic will get up and go over to that door and open it up, and get hit between the eyes, and he'll get knocked back down. And then he'll get up and he'll go over to that door and he'll open it up and he'll get hit between the eyes and knocked down and come back in. And then he'll get up and he'll go over to the door and he'll open it up and he'll get hit between the eyes and knocked down. And he'll get up and he'll get over to the door and he opens it up and gets hit between the eyes and knocked down. One day he goes over to that door to open it up and the guy's gone. So he goes looking for him. Yes, I used to get asked a lot of questions about my drinking and behavior, and one of the questions I used to get asked with great frequency was, Bob, why do you drink the way you drink? I never had a very good verbal answer for that, but what I think went on in my mind was something like this. I said, look, you know, I drink because I have problems. I don't have problems because I drink. If you knew how many times I started out to have things be okay, and it just, you know, went the heck right before my very eyes. If you knew how many times I just flat out been a victim of circumstance, and if you knew some of the problems, you wouldn't ask me why I drink the way I drink. You'd know why I drink the way I drink. I don't drink inappropriately for a person who's got my problems. And at some point in time, they're going to get better, and I'm not going to have a drinking problem, and I wish we'd change the subject. You just don't understand what I'm going through. Please, you know. I was lodged between a sister who got her master's at the Sorbonne in Paris and a brother who was Phi Beta Kappa in law school. And when you're lodged between two show-offs like that, you don't look good. I mean, you know, I'm convinced to this day that the only reason my brother went to law school is to make me look bad. He's practicing law, but I still think it's just so I wouldn't find out that he wanted to make me look bad. But I used to get the question, you know, wouldn't you like to be like... And I'd say, yeah. I'd like to be like. Where are the directions? How do you do it? I mean, honest to God, you know what scared me, and I'm sure it scares you, as bad as it is, it's absolutely all I have. I don't have any other way to do it. I don't know what else. They come to me and they say, you know, Bob, if I heard this next one once, I heard it 190, you know, Bob's a heck of a guy if he just wouldn't drink. You know, well, like most of us, I've had a chance not to drink. Just before I went back to my senior year, I was out in a research project and I was beaten up, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of an apartment building, ended up in the state of shock in an alley. And crawled to a phone booth, called my dad, said, I'm hurt bad, come get me. He said, where are you? I said, I'm in a phone booth. He said, where's the phone booth? And I don't know. He said, by a movie theater, and I passed out. He got my brother out of bed, and they went looking for movie theaters and phone booths, and they found me. Got me to the hospital. I'm waiting for my regular doctor to come patch me up, only my regular doctor doesn't come. The psychiatrist comes, and they're not going to let me go back to school. They want to observe me for a while. And if any of you enjoy my talk here today, you should have heard the one I gave to get out of the psych ward at Miller Hospital 12 and a half years ago. I mean, it was maybe the finest talk I've ever given. And they let me out of that psych ward and go back to school on the condition that I wouldn't drink. And I went back and I didn't drink for about 4 months. And my life didn't get all that much better. I didn't instantaneously become what I thought you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. See, I thought I proved two things to myself. That number one, I could quit drinking anytime I wanted to because I was a daily drinker and I just quit for 4 months. And number two, don't tell me drinking's what's wrong with me, baby, because it's not. There's something that is wrong with me that doesn't have to do with swallowing bourbon. There's something wrong with me that's deep down inside. There's some cancer that you can't see that makes me fail at everything that I touch. They come to me and they say, Bob, I think you're an alcoholic. And I'd say, well, I can see with the information you have why you think I'm an alcoholic. But there's pieces of information about me that you don't have. There's pieces of information about me that no one has. Problems I have before I ever picked up a drink of alcohol. Personal things that I've never told another human being about. And I think if you knew all about those things, you wouldn't think I was just an alcoholic. So thanks a lot for your concern, but get off my back because you don't know what I'm going through. Now that was the attitude with which I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous with. I was 23 years old. I was scared stiff. I didn't know if you were going to give me a test that asked me why I was there, to see if I was an alcoholic or asked me what one was. I didn't know whether to call you by your first names or your last names. I was just confused. And I walked in that meeting and you know what I found. I found a friendly, warm, wonderful group of people who accepted me and understood me more than any other group of people I had ever met anywhere in my life. And in that environment, I was allowed to make two discoveries. One was that alcoholism was a disease. And you say, everybody knows that. Well, I didn't know it. I thought alcoholism was something that happened to you when you were a lot older and a whole lot sloppier and you had a problem living your life because you just couldn't function because you were physically drunk all the time. And that didn't seem to describe me. It described me fairly well, but it didn't seem to describe me. Now, I was told over a period of time that alcoholism was a disease that affected me as a total person. And I'm just add one other thing, get out of the way. I drank twice after I walked in the front door of Alcoholics Anonymous. Once was about 10 days later when I went on a business trip to the West Coast. And once about 2.5 months after that on my honeymoon in Acapulco. And I think everybody in the club knew I was going to drink on my honeymoon except me. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs in Acapulco? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk from a height of 90 feet. They're having the first world's high diving contest at La Quebrada at El Mirador. And after about 9 planters punches, that looks like duck soup. but it's not, and I'm very grateful to be here. Through the grace of God and because this program works, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. That last drink was on my honeymoon in 1967. But I was allowed to make the discovery that alcoholism was a disease. Now, they told me that it was a disease that affected me as a total person, mentally, physically, and spiritually. That once I crossed the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, that my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. And that was important for me to know, because some of the problems I had were happened to me when I was cold stone sober. Now, my defenses were so good that when you wanted to talk to me about drinking, you had to talk to me about swallowing it or throwing it up. I had a very narrow band. I had, trouble connecting bad checks with bourbon. I mean, they just didn't seem to really, fit together. I had a very narrow... I really did have trouble connecting my life problems with drinking. But you told me that it was a disease that affected me as a total person. I remember one guy said to me, he said, "Bob, you don't have a drinking problem." And I said, "Could you put that in writing?" He said, "No, you've got a drinking problem, but that isn't all that's wrong with you. If that was all that was wrong with you, all you'd have to do is quit. But what's wrong with you is alcoholism, the symptom of which is drinking." And Bob, what my idea of alcoholism is he says that once you deal with the physical part and you take your last drink, we use the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12 steps, to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better than what you had before, so that you don't have to go back to drinking or pills to do something for you that you were unwilling or unable to do for yourself. We use the 12 steps to treat the mental and spiritual aspects of the disease. And Bob, if you don't find that new way of life, you're going to go back, because you don't know how to live without it. If there was anything I knew for sure the first couple of weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was that I did not know how to live. It wasn't that I knew I was an alcoholic. That discovery, I think, cemented in me over a period of a number of months. But I was grateful for having heard that message. The other thing I learned is that there was a group of people in that meeting who had drunk and drunk an awful lot of alcohol, and now they weren't doing it. And the only observable reason for them not drinking is they liked that what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. And that intrigued me, because it had occurred to me by this time that I might not be able to drink anymore, but it never even crossed my mind that I could enjoy it. I mean, I didn't like people who didn't drink. I didn't trust them so much in my identity with... People who didn't drink are kind of what I called Irish homosexuals. I should explain that term. An Irish homosexual is an Irishman who likes women better than alcohol. It's an unusual state for an Irish person. But so much of me was caught up in drinking, so much of my identity. I had a fear about what I was going to do, what you were going to give me when you took that away from me. And through the grace of God and the wonderfulness of yourself and this program and my sponsor and all those things, that there wasn't a hole in my life, that I was so busy trying to get well and get about the business of learning a different way to live, that it's just been one of the most wonderful processes I've ever gone through. I heard Chamberlain one time talk about the two fishes that were swimming in the ocean, and the one fish looked over at the other fish and he says, "Isn't the ocean wonderful?" And the other fish looked over and said, "What's the ocean?" That's been my experience in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The very things that I needed in my life, as much and as necessary as breath itself, I never even knew they existed before I walked into the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you handed them to me for free. And I never even knew I needed them. I never knew once you even told me that I wanted them. Such is the power of this program and you people. So many things have happened to me in my sobriety, and I want to share a couple with you. One happened early on. the first thing drinking robbed me of was the little bit extra that it took to be a success at anything that I did. It just kind of took the hop off my fastball. And then pretty soon it started to eat into areas of responsibility, and I wasn't even doing enough to get by. And when that happened to me, I started to lie and cover up, and I started to build a wall between you and me so that you couldn't see what was going on. And the thinking that went on behind the wall went something like this. It said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. But if you could see everything about me, all the dark, unattractive, lousy things about Bob Bazans, you'd hate my guts because I hate my guts. And who knows more what a lousy person I am than me? You see, I was walking around comparing my outsides, my insides, with your outsides. And the only way to come out doing that is second best. And I was hurting badly. But at some point in time behind my wall, I became sick enough and tired enough, and I hurt enough that one day in my fifth step and with my sponsor and in my early experience in AA, I screamed out, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but please just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand it. And for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. I tore my wall down and I let it all out, and I made a discovery. The discovery was is that I wasn't unique. That my personality may be unique, but not my problems and not my illness and not my feelings. I learned something else in that process. See, I shared the part of me with you that made me a moral leper and separated me from everybody else in the world. You didn't judge me. You looked at me and you said, Bob, we understand. And I knew that you did. You know, I've been surrounded by love all my life, but I've never felt particularly loved. But when I came to you, and I think the feeling that went on with that was, you love me, but you don't understand me. If you understood me, you wouldn't love me. But you see, I came to you, and I let it all out, and you understood me. And then you told me, and you showed me that you love me. And I think maybe in the most significant way up until that time in my life that I've ever experienced, I felt loved. And since that time, I've been able to receive love even from people who don't understand me. And that's a gift in the program. Now, a funny thing happened to me, and I think it happens to a lot of us in the program, and that's what I'm going to spend the next 15 minutes talking about, and I'm going to quit. I have failed at everything that I touched prior to coming into this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I came in and intellectually, I was in some ways as phony as a $3 bill, but it's all I had. I can remember early on in AA, I went to meetings 5 and 6 nights a week. I listened to people. I stole their words and ideas. I read books. I wanted to become a young Bill Wilson in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think I sounded better at 6 or 9 months sober than I do today. My sponsor refers to that as being stark raving sober, and I think that that is, I think that that may be an accurate description of how I was another day. But that was my inadequate way of acting as if. I did it as a model. I did it because I was attracted to it. I liked it. I liked everything about it. I didn't want to fail at Alcoholics Anonymous. It just caught me up, and I knew I belonged. I knew it was my answer. I knew it was a full answer for me, not that line of garbage about just don't drink and it's going to be okay. But I found myself 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, a year sober, having problems that you shouldn't have 3 months, 6 months, 9 months sober. So I started to lie about it. I didn't want them to know that I was the youngest person in our group for at least a year, and I'm not sure that I wasn't, for 2 years, the youngest consistent member in our group. Everybody used to pat me on the head and think how proud they were, and oh gosh, I was wonderful. And they'd, you know, once in a while stand me up and say, "Look at Bob," you know. And I didn't want to tell them I was having a problem, and so I lied a little bit, and I'd say, "Thank you very much for helping me with my drinking problem, but stay out of my checkbook," and I'd put a brick up. Say, "Thank you very much for helping me with my drinking problem, but stay out of my marriage," and I'd put another brick up. "Stay out of my job." And brick by brick, I built the wall back up. And you know, you build that wall back up, and you end up alone. You end up unique. You end up having your body at AA meetings, but not you. You end up talking about things that aren't current. You can end up talking about pretty heavy stuff, but it may not be at all what's going on inside. The only thing I can do well alone is get sick. I have to today, and why I'm active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous today, is not for a drinking problem that I had 11 years ago, it's for a living problem that I have today. I'm active in the program and use the 12 steps to treat the mental and spiritual part of my disease that I've got today. Now, we've been given a gift, in my mind, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the gift is that we have an environment of non-judgmental love and understanding that is second to none any place in the world to greet a new person who's got a problem. I jokingly say a new person can walk in that door tonight and tell us he's having a love affair with a zebra, and four people get him a cup of coffee and say that they, too, are having a love affair with a zebra. Let a guy 4 years sober walk in the door and tell us that, and he might get hung. Now, I am not promotive of poor behavior, and understand that. I strive to set high standards in my own life. But I want to tell you something, is that my need for non-judgmental love and understanding is not less today than it was when I walked in the front door. It is as much or greater than it was when I walked in the front door. It is as necessary and essential for me to share me, what's going on in my life today, as it was then. If I don't share what's going on in my life today, I'm walking around with untreated alcoholism. I'm not treating the mental and spiritual aspects of my disease that I have now. And it's been my sad experience that if you walk around with untreated alcoholism long enough, you're going to get drunk. I'm going to share my experience with that event of having untreated alcoholism. I came into the program with what I described to you when I walked in the front door. But I had a set of other, what I thought were other problems. I had behaviors and insufficiencies and defects in me that just were unattractive and drove me nuts and tore my life apart from stem to stern. And my idea was, is okay, let's say I got the disease, and let's say you got the answer. Well, if I've got the disease and you've got the answer, yeah, I'll be able to solve those problems. I got four or five things that are just driving me nuts. And if I've got those and you've got the answer, you've got to be able to make those go away. And I'll be reasonable. I mean, it might take a year. I really expected to find a problem-free life when I came to you. I mean, my sponsor also says that I knew as much about reality as a dog does about his father. One other thing he says about me, and that I suspect that pieces of that are still true. I haven't figured this out. He says, "Bob, you know more than you understand." I've talked it over with my wife, and I'm not sure if that's uncomplimentary. I've gone back and forth on that. And I'm not sure what he means by that. But I literally, like when I was a child, looked at other people and their lives seemed to be so much better than mine. They seemed to have so not near as many problems as I had. They seemed to be live life more easily than I did, and I wanted to know why. And I thought that if I came and did what you told me to do, that I would develop the facility to live life easily and not have the problems that I had. And I tried my best. I had that honeymoon period. God, the first year in AA was awfully good to me. And I was very active, and I had an active sponsor. And thank God, you know, I'm a person that has to hear something about 6 or 7 times. First 2 times, I never even know it was said. The second or third, I start to quote it, don't understand it. The third or fourth, it starts to sink in. And around the 8th or 9th time, I start to get uncomfortable with it and it starts to have an impact on me, and it changed me. Now, because of my activity, I heard a lot of things, 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 times, and it started to get to me. Now, I found myself, I had made considerable progress in my life and in my program the first 5 years. But I found myself 5 and 6 and 7 years sober, continuing to have problems that I was positive I would be rid of if I was practicing the program even just above average well. And I didn't get rid of them. One of the problems I had is I couldn't get up in the morning. I used to set the alarm clock for 6:30 and I'd get up with a crack at 8:29. And I'd go to work, you know, at 9:30, and I'd leave early because I didn't like my job. And when you do that, you aren't generally very successful at what you do. And I was having some financial difficulties. By this time, I'm a father. I'm scared to death of being a father. One of the things I promised myself was I wouldn't be like my father was. You know, like hell I won't be like my father is. It's just like watching television at times. It's just a tough process. I'm scared of it. I'm doing better working at it. But I found myself promising that there were going to be certain things that I was, you know, working on personal problems daily, promising myself that I wasn't going to do them, and daily I do them. Now, not just sometimes, baby. I'm talking about all the time. And about this time, I quit the family business and I started my own company. I went out and I borrowed a year's salary and I'm in financial problems and I'm scared. And one day I was walking along and the thought crossed my mind, Bob, why don't you commit suicide? And I thought before I did that, it might merit talking to my sponsor. And up to this time, of course, I hadn't been very free with sharing that I didn't feel all that good. And it wasn't quite that black and white. This came on me you had taught me so well that I knew that it was unnecessary that I have these problems. That I knew for sure. Because I saw people that I was sponsoring making more progress in some areas of their lives than I was making. I see a new guy walk in that door with all that cancer that a new guy lugs in, and I take him by the hand and we get a cup of coffee. And I'd say, hey, baby, as bad as it is, as hopeless as it seems, if you do the things that we want you to do and you come and walk with us, it's going to be okay. And then I'd get in my car and I'd drive home at 11:30 at night and I'd say, hey, Bob, when's it going to be okay for you? Huh? When's it going to... You're sober 7 years, Bob. Huh? When's it going to be okay? When are you going to be okay? I started at that... By this time, I'm doing a little talking around the country. And I start to notice... I know I'm in need. And I start to go to men and talk to them and spend some time around some of the more senior people in the program, and I start to look and see what I'm missing. And one of the obvious things I'm missing is a strong personal relationship with a higher power. I stopped having that when I was 13 years old. In my faith, when you couldn't play it by the rules, you weren't a full-fledged member, and I stopped playing by the rules when I was about 13, and my concept of God was that of a person who was 13 years old and was developed prior to that. I started to walk through the steps formally again. I took step one and step two and step three and step four as fully and completely as I could, and I called up one of my sponsors and I said, hey, I need some help. We went up to the boardroom of his company, and I took a fist up with that man, and I told him, I said, when I'm done with this, I'm going to do whatever you tell me to do, so you be careful. And we got done, and one of the things he told me to do, he wanted me to go to an industrial psychologist, and I can't explain to you how much I didn't want to do that, but I agreed that I would, and I did, and Linda got involved in that, and that worked out fine. We went there 8 or 9 or 10 times. I got in touch with a few ideas that I wasn't in touch with, and they allowed me to bring them into my program and treat them with the truth of the program of AA. But I found myself searching and reading, and I was into spiritual reading and searching to find a God of my understanding. But you see, I had tried as hard as I knew how for 6 and 7 years to change my behavior and become a better person and get rid of my defects of character, and I failed all the time. Almost daily at those things. And one day in my living room, as I was reading, I realized I was exactly where I was meant to be. And I was given the grace to take the 6th and the 7th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. At that moment, I became entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. I no longer wanted to hang on to those things if they blocked me from what I needed to live. Since that moment, 4 of the 5 major areas of behavior problems that I had disappeared. Have not been a problem at all. It was like being born again, and that's exactly what it was. I had spent 6 and 7 years trying to get rid of my defects of character, and I spent almost no time getting entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character. And a friend of mine said, he said, Bob, you know how we change in the program of AA? And I said, no, how? And he said, this some time ago, he said, you know, a farmer doesn't grow. A farmer creates a fertile soil and plants a seed and God grows. And he said, a doctor doesn't heal. A doctor creates an aseptic environment in which healing can take place and God heals. And he said, we don't change. We create an environment in which change can take place. And God changes us. And the environment is that of the 6th and 7th step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 3 absolutes of having an open mind, being honest, and being willing. I want to report that I believe that. I want to report that as a result of having that experience that I absolutely believe that my program is a total answer to anything that's going on in my life today. I live my program today with a joy and a feeling of completeness that it's marvelous. I don't feel in any sense of the world like I arrived, but I feel more like I'm on the path than I have been at any other point in time. And I know that if I continue to tear my wall down and share with you and my sponsor and my group and my God, not what was going on with me 10 and 11 years ago, but what's going on in my life today, that my needs are going to be met. At the end of what we normally read in How It Works, it says, our descriptions, our personal adventures before and after, and descriptions of the alcoholic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. is that A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. And that B, probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And that C, God could and would if he were sought. One of the questions I asked myself prior to taking step 6 and 7 about 3 or 4 years ago was, Bob, how much time have you spent seeking God? Thank you.